It's The Wonky Show. There's a new wave of naming and shaming coming on VC pay. Is this the bottom of the policy barrel? And university cuts. But what's happening to the student experience? It's all coming up.
It's never easy to persuade somebody that Vice Chancellor's pay is reasonable, but these are really difficult, complex jobs. You know, some of our universities have multi-billion pound turnovers. They've got operations all over the world.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to trim the fat on the week's news, as usual, three excellent guests. In Nottingham, Paul Greatrix is a higher education expert and until recently registrar at the University of Nottingham. Paul, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, my highlight of the week was a deeply personal one, Jim. I was made to feel very, very old at the weekend when I watched my eldest daughter get married.
Oh, wow, fantastic. Did you do a speech and stuff?
I did, yeah. I kept it under an hour, though, so everyone was happy.
Under an hour, fantastic. It's a limit, not a target. In London, Graham Atherton is Associate Pro Vice Chancellor for Regional Engagement at the University of West London. Graham, your highlight of the week, please.
Another personal one, I guess, Jim. My daughter's starting her GCSEs today. So, and she's also doing politics. So let's hope that she does better at politics than maybe I've done. So let's see. Fingers crossed now.
Nail biter. And in Smethwick this morning, Livia Scott is Partnerships Coordinator at Wonky. Livia, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week is also a personal one. I did my final long run. It was 15 kilometres before my half marathon in 2 weeks' time. Well, less than two weeks to go now.
So yes, we start this week with financial sustainability. OFS has just published its annual report on the issue. Paul, what have OFS got to say?
Well, it's not good news, it's fair to say. So the OFS last year did a review of all higher education providers in England's financial positions, and it painted a pretty grim picture then. So last May, the OFS was warning about a number of institutions being at material risk of closure, and overall, the sector looking at deficits in large parts of a large number of institutions, around two-thirds, by 2026-27. And I think what this shows is, bearing in mind we've only just had the opportunity to skim it, is that as it stands now, those predictions have worsened. There'll be more universities in deficit next year, and institutions remain both optimistic about their ability to recruit international students at a time of increasing challenge in that domain, but also optimistic about their ability to recruit domestic students as well. In part, I suspect, to look to mitigate the risk of under-recruitment in the international domain, but also making assumptions about their ability to compete against other institutions in what remains a very, very competitive market. I think the other significant thing that is indicated is that institutions, and this was shown in a recent UUK quick survey of 60 universities, is that a lot of universities are actively looking to save money by shedding jobs. There are redundancy programs, voluntary schemes all over the place, but also compulsory schemes, but also reducing provision on offer. So cutting the number of courses and modules they offer, potentially reducing student choice. But the other, I think, more significant thing is the cuts that are being made, which have been made for many years as well, to fundamental issues around maintenance and around repairs to estates and so forth, which are always the first things to go in a financial challenge. But overall, what that means in the long run is that we'll see a deterioration, a degradation of the experience that students and indeed staff get on their university campuses. So overall, it's a grim prospectus and it's getting worse.
Now, I mean, there's a number of things we could dig into here, but Graham, one of the eye-catching things, I think. So, I mean, you know, in the last few reports, we've had an indication that OFS thinks that international growth projections are over-optimistic, at least collectively. But there's a line in here that says, in aggregate, forecasts continue to predict growth of 26% in UK student entrants. That, between 2023-24 and 2027-28. Now, that's a That can't. How can that? How?
How? Yeah, how? How? Indeed. Anyway, it does seem, I mean, if you look at this report a bit further down, actually, as a chance to do when you guys are speaking, it does actually say that they believe some of the forecasts for providers are over-optimistic here. So how they've reached that figure, I'm not quite sure. It will be consistent with what we've just said. Because the other thing you've also said a few moments ago, Paul, is the numbers of institutions cutting courses and cutting modules and cutting everything else. So they're cutting modules, they're cutting courses, but we're cutting down on the quality of the campus, the quality of the experience, yet we're still hoping to increase the number of students. Those things would seem consistent anyway, despite the fact that we're also the countervailing factors with regards to international recruitment in terms of other markets, visa issues, restrictions in that area as well, which of course are meant to come down the line. And for domestic students as well, of course, cost of living pressures, the wavering when it comes to the view of universities being the only way forward for younger learners. And of course, also the continued flatlining for older students and the lack of the LLE is something to bail that out. But I think particularly, I guess, that the cutting of courses and the cutting of modules is interesting because what's being provided that enables this growth in students then and where? Mm. But also, I mean, it doesn't say anything about increasing because what we've seen in instances that I've seen, well, yes, there has been cutting back in courses, but also growth in other courses, you say, not just existing ones, but certain new courses as well where universities believe there will be students, which could indeed be sort of the ones you're describing as well. And also the regional dimension here as well, something we don't speak about because if we look at London, for instance, we generally aren't seeing the kind of reduction over, if you look at recent data that came out that showed increasing gaps in terms of numbers of students, progression, etc., compared to different parts of the country. So there's a regional dimension to all this as well, as there is with the predictions regarding demographic change. It's always been very different. London's always been at the cusp of that, but other areas have not been, particularly when one gets further north. So there's regional issues here as well to think about.
Now, Livia, let me tell you a story, right? So, you know, I have never been a Vice Chancellor, as you know. but one of the things I have been is the Chief Executive of a Student Union. And in the first year I was, I asked everyone in each of the commercial departments for their budget projections. And they were all mildly optimistic. And actually, when I added all of that up, it added up to quite a significant degree of optimism. And rather than then in the kind of headline numbers that I presented to my board, me then saying, well, not everyone's going to be able to do this, right? It would be a miracle. I just presented the numbers. Then, you know, on the other side of the Excel sheet, there was a bunch of expenditure happening that matched those numbers. Now, that went badly and I learned my lesson. I'm still there? All right. Okay. So that went badly and I learned my lesson. Now, isn't the problem here that that everyone in a university is a bit optimistic? And of course they are because, you know, for a start, they're probably fighting for their job. That then adds up to a level of collective optimism inside a university. And then when OFS looks at the numbers, no wonder there's a level of collective optimism. It's just a faulty way of looking at it, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of don't blame universities for being overly optimistic. One, it's a culture thing. Two, you know, we've had and we still have, in a way, governments that are, you know, quite critical towards universities. We've had a decade essentially of a government telling everybody, you know, universities are not the way forward. You should get an apprenticeship. You should do X, Y, and Z. And universities kind of have to consistently kind of defend their existence and their value. And I think that's probably where some of the optimism comes from, you know, trying to prove, look, students still want to come and study with us. Home students want to study with us. International students want to study with us. And I think I've never been a vice chancellor either, but I think that might be where some of that kind of optimism is just naturally baked in order to kind of prove a point. I do worry because I think it's odd, isn't it, when we read this OFS report that kind of has these optimistic figures. But I bet if you were to kind of go and chat with some vice chancellors, none of them would be kind of this optimistic. I doubt, you know, the kind of the meetings the UK are having with vice chancellors regularly, I doubt they are kind of this optimistic about their growth, about their kind of financial sustainability. It's definitely not the things that we're hearing universities are kind of saying to government. So it just feels, I guess, kind of quite odd to have that. I mean, mind you, from what I've kind of had the chance to scan my eyes down on the report, quite a lot of it is quite negative, I guess, on the kind of financial state of the sector, which, you know, the UUK report kind of backs up.
Paul, here's a question for you, right? So, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13 years ago, so, you know, George Osborne lifts the cap and the assumption is that there's plenty of untapped demand, right? So, you know, in that scenario, broadly what providers are doing is competing for the extra demand. Now that demand has sort of, you know, kind of leveled off for all sorts of reasons, presumably a lot of this is really about universities thinking they can, you know, for want of a better phrase, nick students off each other. Now, you know, there is a different way to run the higher education sector, which would be right at the other extreme, literally allocating the number of places that each university has for each subject and so on. That would certainly calm things down, wouldn't it?
It would be such a handbrake turn from where we are now and everything that has happened in higher education over those 15 years that it would feel really problematic, I think. But there is, I'm sure there is a, you know, sensible middle ground in this, because, you know, this is nuts, right? Having everyone in aggregate predicting an increase of nearly a quarter in terms of UK entrants, right? So that's, you know, hundreds of thousands of extra students who, as you say, aren't, you know, there, or at least would require significant stimulus in order to draw them into institutions. But I do think that, I mean, going back to your point about how universities arrive at their projections for the future, I suspect what we're seeing here is institutions putting those numbers in as a mitigation against a shortfall in international recruitment. So they're already showing that they're not really believing those international numbers, but they have to show that they're going to have a positive future in terms of their budgets. No governing body is, you know, unless it's very, very confident that the turnaround is next year or the year after, is going to start signing off a series of deficit budgets into the future. So, you know, every individual institution and every vice chancellor is going to be confident that they're going to be able to turn it round. But I think that number of domestic students is in large part a hedge against other problems. So it's not real.
Yeah. And not everyone can win. I mean, Graham, you made the point about kind of student experience and courses and modules and so on. In reality, actually, looking through that report, and to be fair, it's a report on financial sustainability, it's pretty thin on what's actually happening to the student experience. Now, you know, Universities UK have put some data out on that this week, but you've been around for long enough to remember when OFS was launched. It was supposed to be about the student interest, not producer interest. Why are we in a situation where we know this level of granular detail about university finances, but honestly, very little about what's actually happening to the student experience on the ground, either from the regulator or in general?
Well, as you say, when it was set up, OFS, it had students in the name, but perhaps, as you know, in the name only, Jim. And I think if we go back to what you said a moment ago about the relatively paucity of apparent ideas from the new government with regards to higher education, perhaps one of those needs to be to really make more robust our understanding of students, how they experience higher education. As you again mentioned earlier on in the show, Jim, the reality is, and we see this in our institution, we have ostensibly full-time students who are actually in reality studying part-time. And that's just the norm across the huge swathes of the sector. Yet we don't want to acknowledge or delve into what that means for students overall. I mean, if we've got ideas in terms of what Labour needs to be doing in terms of an approach to higher education, perhaps really looking at the OFS, looking at its focus on students, as it's, the name should suggest, looking at what this strategy does in terms of understanding what student experience students do, genuine or deeper consultation, maybe an interesting way forward to get beyond some of these figures. As we pointed out from previous guests, actually don't really represent reality at all.
Livia, in the Universities UK survey that came out earlier this week, you know, almost half of institutions that they surveyed have removed module options, and 46% have cut costs on IT. Now, presumably, on one level or another, there are potential consumer protection issues there because a student has signed up for X and they're not in the end getting X, are they?
Yeah, I mean, this, when I was reading it, my brain was just going, ding, 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 ding. This this is potentially a consumer protection issue. It's potentially a breach of a bunch of, in theory, potentially some of the B conditions, particularly around, you know, digital experience and access to digital tools and all of that sort of stuff. I think, so in theory, student protection plans are in place for all providers in England through the OFS. And we know that the OFS, their new condition of registration, I think it's C5 for all providers, this will basically enhance quite a lot of the consumer protection laws, particularly those that are in the new ones that are in the Digital Market Competition and Consumer Act. And while that new condition from the OFS is for all new providers, I think it's quite likely that that will probably come into play for all providers at some point in the future. I guess the kind of question is whether these new regulations will be introduced soon, like in time, I guess, to kind of protect current students. But what those kind of consumer rights are is essentially if a student is currently studying, and some of the stuff that the UK report mentions, if you are removing modules, we know that some students kind of pick a course based on individual modules. I know I picked my kind of study in history. I picked where I studied because of the availability of optional modules. And removing those is kind of a real potentially material difference to the course that a student signed up for, either for those currently applying or for those that are already there. And I think that is the question, that is the concern for a lot of students. And that is kind of where universities should be focusing some of their attention to ensure that they're kind of both serving students and protecting their rights, but are also, I guess, legally kind of covering their own backs when they're making these cuts.
I do think the legal issues are really important. And sorry, Jim, I was going to say, I do think the legal issues are important here, and universities are very, very conscious, arguably excessively cautious in relation to Competition and Markets Authority position on this stuff. So I suspect these course and module closures, some of them will be longer term plans rather than short term, because if a course is already advertised and got people enrolled on it, backing away from that's really hard to do and takes a lot of time and effort and potentially money. The module thing I think is harder, because if people are being made redundant or are voluntarily leaving the institution and they're the only person that teaches that module because they designed it and it's their baby, actually it's very difficult to replace that. And I think you will end up, I'm afraid to say, with some disappointed students. What you have though is in many institutions, and I'm thinking particularly of, you know, institutions that have been around for a long time, is actually a very, very large number of modules which are in many ways very difficult for lots of students to access because of timetabling nightmares. So, actually rationalization is required in many cases because these things have grown like Topsy over many, many years. But it has to be done with the interests of the students very much front and center. And you can't just shut courses overnight.
Yeah. I mean, I think if we look back at the Applied Business Academy closures in the insight brief that came from OFS on that, I think to your point, Paul, the case report there suggested that there basically needed to be more when it comes to clear communication and kind of course mapping of alternative routes, what the alternative provision options are, and, you know, keeping student records up to date. And I think that's where that stuff becomes really important, that, you know, there will be modules that the university just can't replace for a variety of reasons, whether it's because that lecturer is has left voluntarily, whatever it might be. I think the thing here is to make sure that those things are communicated clearly to students, and also kind of what the alternatives are, so that students are aware of what's happening and what their rights are, and, you know, when the university isn't at fault.
I'll tell you what though, Graham, the other thing that really sticks out for me in the UUK report is pretty much half may need to cut hardship funding. 69%, I think it says, may need to cut bursaries. And even things like, you know, half are cutting costs on catering, which I'm assuming means that the cost of a latte and a panini is going to go up on campus. Now, you know, we don't know whether that means they think they're going to have fewer students that need the money. But most universities have only just agreed an access and participation plan that sets out what the entitlements will be on bursaries and hardship funds and so on. You know, should OFS be stepping in and saying, oi, you can't cut spending on that?
Well, the OFS should see the connection between these changes and the access and participation plan for sure, and the implications it could be for learners from different backgrounds. As to whether it will do that, we'll have to see. But and I think particularly when it comes to bursaries and hardship funds, I think we've seen a gradual withering away of these investments anyway over recent years. I mean, through the access and participation plans, it's interesting, for a while there seemed to be a pause in in calculating the amount of money that was spent on these plans, which actually was quite much more prominent back in the kind of mid-2010s, if you like. These things have been put in for a while and reduced for a while, because they'll see an amount of money allocated, but is that in the plan? But is that money actually used? Does it actually reach students? There's a figure in the plan, but does it actually reach students at the end of the day or not? That's the question. Because again, there's all sorts of ways of looking at this in terms of tying up eligibility as well for certain hardship funds and certain bursaries. So another problem.
We've kind of stopped getting reports from MFS, haven't we, on you know, what's you know, certainly in terms of the kind of last, the Chris Millwood round of plans.
Yep.
Don't really know whether they've worked or how much has been spent or whether they've been effective at all, do we?
No, we certainly don't know much about spend, and we don't have much on effectiveness either. I mean, it's been a while since we've had, I think it's, well, since Chris was there, where we've had an overview of access motivation plans, a proper overview that said, this is how much is being spent, these are the key things plans are looking at, it's the kind of progress that's being made. But we've moved away from that. I mean, partly, I think, as plans have become much more individualised to providers, so they've actually they've turned inwards rather than turned outwards, if you like. But I'm particularly concerned about the amount of money spent in these areas, for sure, yeah. And also how assessment of the criteria used to allocate bursaries and hardship funds as well. And there's ways that can be tweaked and tightened all the time to make it more difficult for our students to access these funds, reduce the amount of money that students access each particular point in time.
Paul, obviously on things like access and participation, and on things like, you know, we were talking about student outcomes earlier, you know, in reality, OFS's regulation is fundamentally in England about looking at performance over time. And these financial sustainability issues seem to be happening much, much faster than that fundamental type of regulation can pick up. And surely that means that actually the vanishing point, which is the trade-offs between universities not having enough money and being able to do a series of things that in the kind of public and student interest, we keep missing that vanishing point as a result of this kind of flawed regulatory system, don't we?
I think that's true, Jim, but that's the basis on which the current regulatory regime was set up. And going back to our other discussion around what government is planning this summer in terms of its higher education revival, I do hope that part of what it's going to do is to have a very, very close look at the regulatory regime in England, because I don't think it's quite doing what you need it to do. And I don't think that trade-off, as you say, between, you know, the student interest and the student experience, getting what they pay for, and the public interest and the need for university sustainability is quite right. And my anxiety in all of this is, as you say, that the OFS report is talking about, well, we don't expect any collapses in the very short term, but there's a really good chance it's going to happen in the medium term, wherever the medium term is. But of course, the medium term is always just around the corner, but we are halfway to the medium term already. So action is required. Philip Auger, writing in the FT the other day, talked about secret bailouts of institutions which have already happened. Now, I think he's the only person that I've heard talk about that. He may be the only person who actually knows the secret. But I do think one way or another, we need a regime. Yeah, well, could be. He's a banker. I'm not certain his independent wealth position. But the hold it. What I do hope the government does develop is something that I think Public First, in their report last year, were talking about, a regime which enables universities to get restructuring funds in place to enable them to continue whilst they sort themselves out and get on a safe, secure financial footing, which both protects the interests of students, but also ensures that they remain a going concern. And that's hugely important for lots of towns and cities, and indeed students and staff and their economies up and down the land.
Now, one other thing. In the press release, it says that some superficially attractive options, such as rapid growth in subcontractual partnerships, require caution. Now, anyone really, what is it getting at? I mean, you know, we know the general stuff around partnerships, but why would they be superficially attractive? Because presumably all universities that do this sort of thing are saying, well, you know, it's good for access and participation and so on. And so, I mean, Graham, certainly for, you know, the university where you work, it helps with the APP numbers, doesn't it? All the partnership work?
Well, it does. I think maybe they're getting at the fact that there is a certain risk involved with these relationships, ensuring that, well, we are attracting students from different backgrounds, but we are doing doing it in a way that the student experience, as we mentioned earlier on, is a high enough quality. I do also think, though, when you think about these franchise relationships as well, that what are these providers providing? Why are they providing a kind of higher education that core universities can't provide? And when you come to things talking about risk, et cetera, this is almost factored in. We're building these things into the system. I mean, it's about like the point you made before, Paul, about the call for restructuring funds. Like, I can see the case for restructuring funds, but it's almost compensating for what we have as systemic failure. Let's build some funds to allow the system to continue to fail and not work properly. And well, you know, I think different forms of provision, different kinds of providers will provide opportunities for students. They are these franchise providers focus on particular subject areas, particular kinds of provider. Why is it that they can't have an education experience in other ways?
I mean, I guess the thing is, Paul, right, if some of this franchise provision that is around, the kind of, you know, heavily stacked in big cities business studies type stuff, if we were in further education, providers would have to set out, when they do franchising, the way in which they're sort of meeting needs that otherwise the rest of the FE sector isn't meeting. Now, surely no one could turn around and say there's a shortage of business studies courses, could they?
No, I agree. But I mean, I think, as Graham says, there is a legitimate argument to be made that some of this subcontracted provision is actually providing education in cold spots around the country where students simply wouldn't have access to HE otherwise. And so I think, you know, that is absolutely legitimate. I think the risk issue comes where you are doing it for reasons other than educational. So if you're doing it simply to make money, as I fear some institutions might well be because of the difficult financial situation they're in, then the quality of the provision and the educational experience offered to students is not your primary concern, then I think we're in difficulty. And that's where you end up with, as you say, these tower blocks full of business students rather than the outreach activity that actually brings material benefit in terms of access and widening participation.
Yes, I think also, as Paul said, I think that the risk also becomes when these expansion may happen too quickly, where there's the capacity to manage that relationship appropriately. Because in any kinds of franchise relationship, there's a relationship to manage there, and the franchisor, if you like, has to be able to undertake that relationship appropriately. I think also on Paul's point, there is a game back to our main really on geographical points here. I mean, if back to your point, Jim, about in a more planned system, would you think about this being a tool for access and participation in areas where they're all cold spots? You couldn't argue, for instance, that the provision in London is necessarily a cold spot issue. There's plenty of provision in London. There's never a cold spot.
Olivia, let me ask you this one other question. So I've written a couple of pieces on the site over the past couple of weeks. One about University of Helsinki, where the system suffered quite significant headline cuts from government, you know, about a decade ago, and had to make a series of adjustments. And also been to Portugal on our study tour and seen, you know, some significant kind of curriculum reforms. And one of the threads in both of them was students being able to, and in some cases required to, study core modules outside of their subject area. Now, you know, that seems to be really good for them because that enables them to be a kind of rounded graduate. It also reduces the university's costs. Now, actually, what I keep seeing in universities in the UK, and to some extent this is reflected in the UUK report, is just getting rid of a lot of optionality and just, you know, sticking to core modules in a small program rather than some of these kind of bigger, interesting structural changes. Why are we sort of trapped in this just keep reducing the costs thing rather than thinking more imaginatively in the UK?
I don't know. I've asked myself the same question a lot of times. And I think part of it is that in the UK, traditionally, higher education is very specific. You can specialize in a very kind of niche area very quickly, very early on. And you pick, you know, you kind of almost choose your academic destiny when you're 16 and you do A-levels. Whereas that's not quite as common in kind of other countries in Europe. Now, I'm not saying we should change A-levels, kind of, you know, keep them as they are. But I think there is a question here There's a question here around why is it that when we're looking at kind of reducing module choices, we're looking constantly at kind of cutting rather than is there a way forward in that? For example, if in one department or if you're in a university where kind of your faculty is being merged with another faculty and you're kind of going to become one big school because you're having 8 departments rather than 12 because of cuts, whatever it might be, I think there's a conversation to be had around how can we do more when it comes to kind of interdisciplinary modules, which I know lots of universities do. You know, Angela Ruskin has their brilliant Ruskin modules. But I think there's an opportunity here to think about what is it the skills that we want our graduates to have? And the government is very focused on skills. We know that. How do we as universities be imaginative, think about, you know, both financial sustainability, but also what we want our graduates to have and their outcomes to be? And is there a way that we can think creatively that these core modules that perhaps more students do, that there is, for example, a humanities core module, and then that might think also about, you know, kind of wider graduate skills. It might think about kind of civic things, getting involved with charity work, involved with kind of local government or whatever it might be. I think there's a conversation here that universities should be having around, if we are cutting modules, how can we be creative to make sure that the modules we do have remaining are both interesting and exciting for students and staff, but also fulfill the aims, the kind of skills aims that we have for graduates.
I think that's right. But I mean, Livia's absolutely correct. In a sane and rational world, what universities would be doing, and ideally actually would have already done, is to say, well, look, our fundamental offer is about the, you know, based on the quality of the curriculum that we offer to prospective students, let's step back and spend some serious time ensuring we plan it in a way that, you know, gives them the best possible educational experience, the most opportunities, the most variety, but also gives them the best future prospects as well. But of course, that's a really, really, really big thing to do. And some universities have done it. I remember the University of Melbourne, you know, did it quite a few years ago. And other universities do this kind of grand curriculum planning from time to time. But it's really difficult, time consuming, and actually requires everyone to agree with the outcome. Whereas in fact, most universities are lots of little educational fiefdoms where they want to do their own thing because they're the experts. And actually then trying to aggregate all that together, you get huge complexity, which satisfies no one. So I think, you know, that would be the way to do it. But of course, all the other priorities mean that actually that looks like it's too big, too difficult, too long term. But, you know, that's what I think should be happening. Incidentally, I was reminded only recently, I recorded a podcast with Chris Husbands, former VC at Sheffield Hallam, on his imaginary university. And it was, in fact, the curriculum was just as Livia described it.
Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Ed Stevens, and I work in Impact and Knowledge Exchange for the Faculty of Arts and Humanities at King's College London. This week on Wonky, I've been blogging about activists in residence programmes. These are programmes where activists work alongside students and academics on projects with a social justice focus. And we've been running such programmes for about 5 years. Through our blog, we explore how these intentional spaces for activists' academic work may act as institutional irritants, enabling quiet acts of rebellion. We suggest that participants are able to explore different ways of being, doing, and knowing, and that activists and academic identities blur, evolve, and coexist, enabling the programmes to become sites of radical possibility.
Now, next up, the government seems to be ramping up pressure on university spending and executive pay. Livia, what's going on here?
So it seems like the wheel has spun and it's time for Vice Chancellor Pay to be back in the news to churn up some more public outrage about universities. What's happened is the Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, potentially in response to the potential threat to her job and the June reshuffle that's coming, she's kind of come out swinging this week on how she intends to stop wasteful spending in universities. And this time it's that age-old question that everyone loves to talk about of Vice Chancellor pay packages. And she wants to introduce a publishing of tables which will detail the pay at universities where there is a significant number of graduates that do not go on to quote-unquote good jobs. And part of this clampdown over providing value for money, she wants to to require universities to provide more evidence of what exactly it is that they do to improve students' jobs prospects and how they provide value for money. So this could, for English providers, be by requiring the Office for Students to update registration conditions to require universities to do more around quality of teaching. But she hasn't quite made clear what exactly that is yet. So the scoop came out in the Times over the weekend with some pretty mad quotes about hard rain falling down on vice chancellors, and then vice chancellors are going to be removed from their ivory towers or some such like that.
So, Paul, a hard rain is going to fall on universities that continue to be so blasé about executive pay increases while letting down students. What do you think about that?
Well, it does sound a little bit desperate for this early in a parliament to be scraping around for this kind of initiative in relation to higher education, given everything else on the agenda. And I have to say, I always think that when people are reaching for, you know, Bob Dylan quotes as well, that they're really not necessarily speaking to everyone in quite the right way. So it does feel a little bit, you know, misguided, to be honest, and also very, very difficult to do. There are ways to address, if one is genuinely serious, issues of concern around vice chancellor pay. But it's been, you know, top of the list for many previous secretaries of state, and none of them have actually achieved anything meaningful in this regard. The idea of naming and shaming happens on a regular basis already. But I think, I'm afraid, you know, it's a bit dull to say it, but the data does on the whole suggest that for most universities, actually, you know, vice chancellor pay has been on the whole, you know, rather reasonably constrained over the past 15 years or so. But of course, they're starting from quite a high base and they look pricey compared with everyone else in university. As to how you compare that with graduate outcomes, goodness only knows. And which universities they're looking at for their evidence, I don't know either. But this feels a bit desperate to me.
Now, Universities UK's Vivian Stern was on the Today programme officially to talk about the survey they'd done on university spending reductions, but actually, perhaps unsurprisingly, the programme wanted to talk about VC pay. Let's have a listen.
It's never easy to persuade somebody that vice-chancellor's pay is reasonable, but these are really difficult, complex jobs. You know, some of our universities have multi-billion pound turnovers. They've got operations all over the world. You have to be pretty entrepreneurial to run a university. You have to have the ability to grip extraordinary financial challenges, which we'll come to. So you need people who've got, you know, a very, very sophisticated set of leadership skills. They also need to be able to withstand, you know, the scrutiny of government, of regulators, of students, of staff, of the media. Yeah, they're very well paid, but they're paid well to do an extraordinarily difficult job.
Vivian Stern, Chief Executive of the Universities UK, thank you.
Now, I mean, I guess there's lots of different ways into this, Graham. I mean, one of the interesting things I think about the sort of Times story is that whoever's briefed the Times seems to be sort of fusing two classic sort of clickbait lines, one on VC pay and one on graduate outcomes. But, you know, would it make sense to link graduate outcomes to vice chancellor pay?
I don't think significantly, no. I mean, again, it reiterates or convinces the idea that vice chancellors are somehow omnipotent, and it's the vice chancellor's pay, it's the vice chancellor's responsibility to lead to graduate outcomes, which isn't reality. I mean, vice chancellors do have power in universities, and their universities are hierarchical, but as we all know, they're not really built that way. So building that relationship really doesn't work. I mean, what worries me as well is the idea that for a Labour government, that this kind of phrase, this kind of view will have political currency. It worries me that this is seen to be impactful. This is the way that you deal with universities, by putting these ideas out again, whether it's coincidental with the pressures they're facing from certain political parties, the way they see the need to appeal to certain kind of voters. But it does worry me that these ideas will come out, not just in terms of a lack of overall ideas that Labour would have, but they would be used in this kind of way as a way of understanding universities. But certainly, I don't think they really make much sense when it comes to graduate outcomes now.
Livia, I was having a question the other day with a bunch of researchers who've been talking to a bunch of students in the East Midlands, funnily enough, and they were pretty much only experiencing their curriculum, right? So in other words, they were, you know, they'd got very long commutes, they'd got, you know, all
almost full-time jobs, and their student experience was the curriculum. And one of the things they were worried about was they wouldn't really have much to say to a graduate recruiter on graduation. Now, the government has to take some level of responsibility for that, doesn't it, when we're talking about graduate outcomes?
I think so. And I think the government does have to take some responsibility. But to me, that this is an issue that we're kind of having a conversation about things that won't solve the issue that the government wants to solve, which is surely improving graduate outcomes and improving skills of young people or kind of all people in education. And the way to do that is not to cut VC pay. And, you know, I feel like I'm betraying my student union roots to defend VC pay packages, but it's nonsensical to kind of suggest that cutting VC pay would improve graduate outcomes. The link is so tenuous. I think if the government is serious about, you know, wanting to kind of improve the outcomes of students that you mentioned, Jim, that basically they are pretty much full-time workers and full-time students. They're just doing their courses. That is about thinking about, okay, well, what is the curriculum within universities? That's, to me, thinking about kind of the skills agenda and how do we build both soft and kind of hard skills into the curriculum in and of itself. And that's something that I'm sure a lot of universities would kind of welcome support from the government on. But having this conversation through the lens of VC pay it just doesn't make any sense at all. And the idea that the government wants to kind of make universities more accountable for VC pay, that already exists within OFS conditions. It's already in, I think it's condition E3. It requires like accounts to justify the total remuneration packages for head of providers. This stuff does already exist. As Paul said, it's VC pay has kind of been curbed within the past decade. And if we're having a conversation about skills, let's have that one. But if we want to have a conversation about VC pay, we're just going to end up in a constant doom cycle because we've been here before.
Thing is though, Paul, right? So you know, I mean, universities are quasi public bodies. You know, they're kind of, you know, a bit public, and you know, they also have a character of kind of private institutions to some extent in a market. But people are going to say, students, the public, you know, staff that work in universities, people are going to say, well, on what basis are you paying that amount of money to the VC? And there isn't really a very clear story to tell, is there?
I mean, I think there is, but it never sounds good. Pay is set by ultimately the governing body of the institution. And in order to recruit a VC, you are often operating in a competitive market, often an international competitive market, where you're trying to recruit someone from Australia or the US who will already be on a much higher salary than most of their peers in the UK. So it's actually quite difficult to land a VC in that kind of international competitive market without offering more. So I think, and then if they do well, they do expect their pay to go up. Of course, it's very reasonable to say if they don't do well, then their pay shouldn't go up at all. And that's the case in many institutions too. But I mean, it does just look, you know, odd, because they are paid so relatively well compared with larger numbers of people in their institutions. But the structure, the governance structure, is intended to control that. But it can be very difficult when you're looking to compete internationally at the time of recruitment.
Graham, this thing about international competitiveness is interesting, isn't it? Because there's lots of European countries where not only is the kind of head of the institution elected rather than employed, their pay is also capped. So, you know, one of the things I put in my blog this week was in the Netherlands, pay is capped at €200,000. And it doesn't look to me like the sky has fallen in.
No, I'd agree. I mean, I think also, though, in terms of pay, I mean, there's a couple of things. I mean, I think in this country, once one becomes a VC, one becomes a VC. And it's not always the case that their future trajectory is related to performance. So, you know, there is possibly the chance of failing upwards when you're a VC to an extent. You may have seen that in certain instances. Secondly, in terms of your point about Europe, I think also, though, in Europe, the relationship between CEO pay across society is different as well. The relationship between how people are paid at top level. We look at the CEO pay in the private sector in the UK, you would argue it probably outstrips that sort of pay in private sector in Europe. But I think if you're going to talk about limiting pay, though, you also do you link that to graduate outcomes or not? Because we're getting into a debate of, is it fair or reasonable that VC should be paid this amount, or should that pay be related to graduate outcomes? Two things are slightly different. But I mean, I guess it's about the market. I mean, I think the international question does pertain to certain parts of the sector. If you look to the evidence, probably to others, it's not. If you look to parts of the sector and you say, how many you know, as VCs actually drawn from outside this country, the evidence would dictate probably very few.
Livia, I guess the other thing that I find kind of vaguely interesting about this is that, you know, the VC pay thing pops up quite often, but one of the things you don't hear much of, unless I'm sort of missing it, is critique of multi-academy trust leader pay. And over in that part of the education sector, which Bridget Phillipson also has a level of responsibility for, there are some, you know, there are similar issues in terms of kind of rocketing salaries in multi-academy trusts. And, you know, at least in theory, lots of people are debating the idea of whether or not we should move towards that kind of model as a kind of, as a way of avoiding full-blown merger in HE.
I mean, yeah, I guess the issues are kind of related in the sense that if we're kind of going to have one rule for one, let's have one rule for another. I think there is a question around, essentially, if the government and OFS are going to try and kind of claw back some of VC pay, but they're doing so in the context of financial catastrophe or to kind of protect money. And I think there is a question around if we do, you know, if we are going to mergers and that kind of thing, are kind of heads of institution going to expect kind of more money rather than less? You know, if they're overseeing, in theory, what used to be three providers and it's now one. I think there's a conversation to be had about if we want to talk about VC pay and we want to talk about that through the lens of, okay, universities are struggling financially, that's a conversation that the government can have, but we need to be talking about it kind of in a future planning way. So if in the event of mergers, what does VC pay and remuneration packages look like there within the wider education sector, rather than it just being, which is what it always feels like, let's attack universities, let's have a go at universities because it'll make headlines and it'll make us look good as a government.
Point earlier, didn't you? I mean, when I read the piece, you know, my eyes rolled quite far back into my head. I mean, does this signal that the government really has no decent ideas for higher education? Because we are, in theory, hurtling towards some sort of, you know, plan in June, or at least, you know, the promise is the summer, isn't it? Some sort of higher education plan.
Yeah, I sincerely hope that there is a lot more in the oven, right, than this. And this was just a quick off-the-cuff response to a particular set of queries from a journalist or something, right? Because it's not thought through, it's half-baked. We know there is a plan being developed, and I'm hoping that it will be something that will be significant and material and address the sector challenges that we face, given that they're coming at us in a number of different directions. This will not solve anyone's problems at all. It is simply about a headline. So, you know, that's why it's doubly distressing, to be honest. But I'm, you know, I could be proved wrong, but I do hope that the plan, which I have absolutely nil insight into at all, I'm just hoping, will be a bit more comprehensive and a lot better thought through than this kind of, you know, scrappiness.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Paul, Graham, Livia, Michael, Salmon for making it all happen. We'll be back next week. Mark will be here. Until then, stay wonky.